Okay, we'll start. Sorry we're late. We've had some trouble with the readings and stuff like that. If you haven't been here yet, the story goes like this. We're covering a book called The Garden, and it's a story of meetings with the great Buddhist masters of history. So this guy is going to a special garden, and in the garden he keeps bumping into he's waiting actually for his girlfriend, but she never shows up, and seems like and these Buddhist masters keep coming to this garden, and so he's been meeting them one by one. The ideas that we've gone over so far, the first one was that this story is being written from the point of view of later in this person's life, much later. And they're looking back on events in the garden, the person who took them to the garden the first time, which is a girlfriend, and they're starting to realize that now what they know about Buddhism and Buddhas is that very possibly the people that you grew up with, a certain number of them may have been enlightened beings. Okay? Like, they start to realize later in his life, this person in the story is starting to realize that one or more of the people that he met early in his life could have been an enlightened being, could have been a Buddha. And he starts to see from the point of view of 20, 30 years later that this was very possible and even very likely. You know that later on, after you reach some kind of spiritual levels, you can look back and realize that certain people in your life nudged you a certain way. It could have been a pleasant nudge or it could have been an unpleasant nudge, okay? But they were trying to help you. They were trying to get you to go somewhere. And they did. You see what I mean? And you'll be able to look back later from the point of view of a different state of mind after a lot of Buddhist practice, a lot of Buddhist meditation, that you actually have an ability to look back in a different state of consciousness and realize that many of the events that happened in your life, good or bad, okay, very good, very bad, that the person involved, someone who died next to you, you know, someone who broke up with you, somebody who was your mother or something, you know, those people all could have been enlightened beings. You have to realize that we're trying to get to a goal, which is an enlightened being has the ability to be anything they want, anytime they want, anywhere they want, and they have this ability to make multiple copies. So it's called tuku or nirmanakaya. So they have an ability to fill up a whole auditorium so that I can review my practice, you know, like that. Could be one Buddha, could be two. Okay. Usually two don't gang up and make one person, so we can say probably not more than 100 here or something like that. Okay, but anyway, this is what the man in the story is realizing in his later years. So that was the first chapter. Second chapter was about pain. And he was having an argument with, he's waiting for his girlfriend to come back to his garden, and instead Jetsonkapa comes. Jetsonkapa was a great Buddhist teacher in Tibet he was the teacher of the first Dalai Lama about 500 years ago. And so he's sort of disappointed that it's not his girlfriend, but Jetsonkapa is okay. And this great Lama comes into the garden, and they start to have a debate about pain. And Jetsonkapa is saying, tell me about your life. And the guy says, oh, my life's pretty good. You know, I got to go to university. I'm pretty well educated. I have a good place to stay. I have a pretty good job. I'm pretty healthy. Things are going pretty well. You know, and Jetsonkapa says, well, it's a pity to hear that you're wasting every moment of your precious life, you know. And the guy says, I'm not wasting my life, you know, I'm living a reasonable life. You know, so he's like, the guy's trying to say, look, I'm not trying to be the president, and I'm not trying to be, you know, Donald Trump, or I'm not trying to be something big. I just want to live a normal, happy life. I want to be medium income. You know, I don't have to be rich. I don't want to be poor. But I'm not greedy. I don't have that problem. I know that's a trap. You know, I'm not stupid. I have spiritual longings. I want to be a spiritual person. But I want to have a normal family, a normal house, a decent job. And then I want to do some meditation every day. You know, just enough to be calm. And stuff like that. And that's my goal in life. And then Jetsonkapa repeats, it's a pity that you're wasting every moment of your life. You know, and then the guy says, I'm not wasting my life. And then they start an argument, you know, and Jetsonkapa says, you are, because your whole life is pain. and you're not trying to do anything about it. You know, you want to have a good house. Good house is pain. You want to have a normal wife. This is pain. You want to have nice kids, normal kids. You want to have a normal medium income. This is pain. Everything is pain. And the guy is like, come on, you know, don't be radical. There is pain in life. You know, I've been sick before. I've been broke before. You know, I've had people break up with me before, stuff like that. But that's like from time to time, bad things happen. But you can't say my whole life, every minute of my life has been a waste, you know. I've accomplished things. I went to school. You know, I'm a normal person. I'm sensitive. I'm spiritually inclined. I'm not greedy, you know. I like other people. I do good things for people. You know, and Jeff and Kappa says, well, I'm sorry to hear you're wasting every moment of your life, you know. So then they get in this big argument about, is this Buddhist thing about every moment of your life being pain, is it true or not? You know, because I know for me as an American, it was like, okay, gyeganachi, birth, rebirth, aging, sickness, death. You know, this is what Buddha said is your problems. And I'm 22 years old, and my lama's telling me this, and I'm like, gewa, rebirth, I don't believe in. So I don't have to worry about that. Gawa, I'm old age, I'm 22 years old, you know. Tell me about it later. Nawa, I get sick once in a while, but I don't have cancer or anything. I don't have a heart problem, you know. It doesn't apply to me. Chiwa, dying, I still have, you know, 58 years, or so, you know, like medium lifespan, and I'm just thinking it doesn't impress me, this argument. You know, the Buddha's big pronouncement about the suffering of life doesn't seem to be relevant to me. Maybe to somebody in a hospital or a nursing home or something like that, but right now I'm not there. Jetha Kapa, if he were alive, would say, no, you don't get it. Every hour of your life is total suffering. It's not that you have bad events happening from time to time. The fact that you're sitting in this room right now is suffering. You know, the fact that you're breathing right now is a kind of suffering. You know, and then the guy is like, I don't get it. Are you telling me that, you know, we had a nice kid here last time. She went away to Canada. But anyway, by the way, I'll tell you something about that child. But anyway, the child was sitting here. And in the story, the guy says, take the beauty of a sunset. You know, take the beauty of a flower. Take a beautiful song. Neil Young. Take anything beautiful, the face of a child, you know, like a happy child's face. You know, you can't tell me this is suffering, you know. And then Jetson Kapa says, so I guess licking razor blades is not suffering, right? And the guy says, come on, don't be gross, you know, licking razor blades, who would do that? And he says, well, let's say that you have a razor blade covered with honey, and you know, somebody says, do you want to lick it? And you don't realize there's a razor blade under the honey. So you say, okay, yeah, I like honey. Like, I have friends who just go around with jars of honey and eating it, you know. Especially Leroy's. I don't know if... Anyway. Hawaiian white honey. So he says, yeah, no, eating honey is a pleasure. You know, I'd love to eat some honey. Anytime I could lick some honey off something, okay. And then Jeff Kappa says, okay, did you decide licking honey is a pleasure? And the guy says, yeah, licking honey is pleasure. So then Jeff Kappa says, well, is it pleasure when you stick it on a razor blade and go, ah, you know. And the guy says, well, if I think about it carefully, you know, no, the first moment, you know, you probably have an instant taste of the honey, you know, probably for half a second or something, and then you become aware of the pain. So there's like a half a second of pleasure, and then there's just this very, very serious pain, you know. So then Jetson Kapa says, so are you telling me, oh, then he says, is licking honey a pleasure? The guy says, yes. Is licking honey off a razor blade pleasure? He says, no. And Jetha Kapa says, but isn't it pleasure in the first moment? In the very first instant? He says, yes. But that doesn't make it pleasure. And Jetha Kapa says, why? And he's playing chess with him. You see, he's about to get him. This is in the monastery. They do it to you all the time. They ask you questions and suddenly you're trapped. You know, so he says, so licking honey is pleasure? Yeah. Licking honey off a razor blade is pleasure or pain? Well, you know, the first moment might be pleasure, but you have to call it pain. And Jetha Kapa says, why? And the guy says, because the necessary, it's connected. It is absolutely connected to a major pain right after it. You know what I mean? So licking honey off a razor blade, because it's, I don't know how to say, because it's indubitably, indisputably connected to a suffering, a big suffering in the next instant, it's not worth it. You can't call it pleasure. It's pain. So Jetson Kapa says, oh, are you saying then that if you have some short pleasure And then after that, you have some big, you know, suffering that you can call both of them together suffering. Okay? Get it? So you take that moment's pleasure and the razor blade cut, and you glue them together, and you say, now what about that whole event of licking a razor blade that has honey on it? Is that pleasure or pain? And the guy says, pain. And he says, why? Because the pleasure always comes with a bad ending, a very bad ending. You know what I mean? In this case. So you can't say that it's like mixed pleasure and pain. Come on, it's painful to lick razor blades with honey on them, okay? So Jepson Kaba says, well, think of the child's face. And then he leaves the garden, you know, and he leaves the guy like that. And the guy's thinking, what did he mean? What did he mean? And the point is, no matter what kind of good thing happens to you in this life, you must get old. You must die. You must lose everything you worked for. You know, every single thing you ever worked for, every morning that you got up out of bed, it doesn't matter what you worked for. And you don't have to be a greedy person. I'm not talking greedy. Every single action that you undertook in this life for something to happen that you wanted is meaningless as you get old and it all starts to fall apart and as you die. So it doesn't... We were talking last night about how fast it takes, how little time it takes your children to sell the house and spend the money. You know? And you know many people who have spent their whole lives. Often you ask them, is life worth it? And they say, no. I said, well, why are you still working? Well, at least my children can have something, you know. And then you say, what? You know, and they'll say, after I die, they'll sell the house and they'll have some money for a while, you know, and then they'll die. So what's the point? You know, and then, so that's the idea. That's the razor blade. Nothing that you've ever done in this life, collecting friends, having a family, having a house, having a career, getting money together, even a reasonable, spiritual, sensitive person's money, it's all useless. It's meaningless. It becomes meaningless because it ends in that. It's connected to that. It's always connected to that. So according to your own idea, it's the same as licking honey off a razor blade. There's no reason to want those things now. Okay, and then the guy leaves the garden. You know, he says, okay, I've proved that you're living in pain all the time. You're licking razor blades all the time. You know, and he leaves. Yeah. Okay, good.
Said,
at least one person.
You said one of the suffering, it might have been the second one, that things that come together will always fall apart.
Yeah.
And things that are meaningful to you will be destroyed. I've heard this from the people that are not Buddhists, and it seems like a sense of wisdom that, you know, you have something that's good now, enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's not going to be good forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what you're saying is, what he said basically is this. There are non-Buddhist people who have found chunks of meaning in their life. You know what I mean? It's not meaningless, right? There have been...
And even accepting that they'll fall apart, you know, that wisdom.
This is a good question, you know. Like, I agree with the idea that any good thing that happens to me will fall apart. But that doesn't make that good thing invalid, you know? So what you're saying is, you know, you can't say that the first moment of the honey is not sweet, even if it's connected to a gash in your tongue. You see what I mean? That's the whole argument. That's what the young man's trying to say, and that's what Jepson Kaba is trying to tell him. But I think the answer to that is this. Is there an option? You see, I call it, is the Buddhist goal, and this is very important, is it the goal of Buddhism to learn to cope with your pain? You know, is it the goal of Buddhism to be a master coper? Really? You see, I mean, because many people present Buddhism that way, or seems to present Buddhism that way. You know, you can't change your life. You're going to get old. You're going to suffer. You're going to die. Things are going to fall apart. But learn to be calm. You know, learn to cope. You know, learn to be peaceful as it falls apart around you, and as your body gets less and less able to sit in meditation, for example, until the final day that you can't sit up anymore, just take it easy. Watch it flow. Watch the thoughts come in and out of your mind. Be calm. Be friendly to others, because everyone's in the same boat. I mean, that's oftentimes you hear that. It's not the goal of Buddhism. Forget it, okay? It's not to sit there and put up with a world which is falling apart around you. It's not, the purpose of Buddhist practice is not to sit in a room and cope with a life which is suffering. It's to remove the suffering. It's a big difference. You see, I mean, a good Buddhist practitioner is not learning to be peaceful and calm while their life is being torn down by time. You know, it's to get out of that. It's to stop it. You see, it's very radical. And I had a lady today, she's a famous author, that she wrote a book called Cave in the Snow or something like that. She's the writer of it, the ghostwriter. And she said, I'll write you a ghostwriter book for you, you know, but you got to stop this stuff about people don't have to die, you know. It won't go. Can't you just, you know, can't you just talk about meditation or something, you know? And no, it's not the point of Buddhism, really. And it sounds, she said, you sound like Walt Disney on a bad day, you know, and on an acid trip. She said something like that. But this is what the Buddha said, right in the middle of the Heart Sutra. I said, do you accept that the Heart Sutra is the most famous Buddhist book there is? And she says, yes. Right in the middle, he says, Marikpa mema rikpa sepa mepa ne gashi me gashi sepa pari yamedo, which means you don't have to die. You know, you don't have to get old. If you just figure out what's happening, you don't have to go through that process. So she says, well, why didn't we see anybody like that? And the point is, until you get pretty much into the process, you can't see it. But there are people all around who are doing it. You see, I mean, then she said, how do you prove that? And then we got into a 4-hour talk. Anyway, we don't have that much time. So that what I wanted to say is that the point of Buddhism is truly not to just learn to cope with things. You see what I mean? It's not to learn to enjoy the short time you have or something like that. The real goal of Buddhism is to actually stop the process of aging and death. And I don't... Sometimes I think I shouldn't say that because then people say he's crazy and they don't come back to class. You know, if he had talked about meditation, it would have been comfortable for me. But really, that's the goal, and that's the reason to be a Buddhist, and that's the reason to... The goal of Buddhism is not to learn to enjoy the short periods in your life where things aren't screwing up. The goal of Buddhism is to make sure they don't stop. And that's a big difference, okay? That's a big difference. I'm not denying that, you know, there are ways of seeing the world in which you can enjoy your good years, you know, but the point is, if there's always a razor blade at the other end of it, if you had an option, wouldn't you want to try the other way? That's all. Okay. So he leaves the garden. The guy thinks about it for a while. His mother has died in the meantime, okay? And he's dealing with this grief subconsciously. And he wants to get out of it. You know, when you have someone close to you die, you become a real Buddhist for a short time. They call it in Pusu Nyenjum. Pusu Nyenjum means goosebump spirituality, which means for about 6 weeks you're really spiritual, you know, and then for about 6 months you're subconsciously spiritual. You see, I mean, you're not dealing with the guy at work that you don't like, or, you know, getting to the right restaurant or something like that. Subconsciously, you're dealing with, is death inevitable? You know, can I speak to my mother after she died? Where is she? What happened to her? Subconsciously, you're dealing with those issues for about 6 weeks consciously and 6 months to a year or more subconsciously. So that's the right time to get somebody interested in Buddhism. You see what I mean? Because for a short time, you're dealing with the real problems of life. And then you go back to the dumb stuff. Okay? So this guy in the story has had this event happen to him. His mother has died. So he's going back to the garden, and he's thinking that this girl might come. And instead, he hears the footsteps of... This is at night, right? So he's got his eyes closed. She has a distinctive gait, like a skipping sort of walk. And his eyes are closed, and he's listening. But he hears this clump, 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 you know, and he's like, oh boy, it's not her. I wonder who's going to bother me tonight. And in comes this guy named Kamalashila. I like you to repeat the Tibetan because it puts a seed in your mind and it comes out 100 years later or something. We'll meet again, okay? Say, this class won't go on 100 years tonight, okay? Say, Kamala.
Kamala.
Sheila.
Sheila.
Kamala.
Kamala.
Sheila.
Sheila.
Okay, Kamala Sheila lived about 750 AD. Came from India. Great, great Buddhist meditator. Okay, maybe the best of all time. So this guy happens to be meeting the best of everything, okay, in this garden. He wrote a book called Gomrim. Gom means meditation. Rim means steps to how to meditate. And this is the classic that's been used in Tibet ever since. Okay, so every Tibetan monk and every Tibetan monastery is meditating based on this book. Gomrim, the steps on how to meditate. And he's going to get taught meditation by Kamala Sheila in the garden. Okay, and it's going to be this process. All right. Kamala Sheila is very famous in Tibet. The Tibetans, for example, before they became Buddhist, they didn't have an alphabet. They didn't write anything. And after they got interested in Buddhism, the king said, you know what? Might be nice to have an alphabet. So we can write down all this stuff that these Indian guys are saying when they come to our country. So he sent like a team of 15, 16 young men to India and said, don't come back without it. So they went to India. Tibetans don't do well in India. India is a low plain, and they're used to very little oxygen. Their lungs are very expanded. They get tuberculosis very easily. Like the refugees in 1959, thousands and thousands died of tuberculosis. And out of the 16 young men, all but one or two died. Okay, one guy made it back, and he wrote a book called Sumtak and Sumchupa, Tangajupa. And he started the alphabet, okay, Tumi Sambora. And he came back and they had an alphabet. Just like that, the Tibetans at some point decided, we want to learn how to meditate, okay, as a nation. It was really cool in Tibet because the kings were the ones who brought Buddhism to Tibet. You know, it was like having Clinton suddenly get interested and put the whole Pentagon on getting Tibetan lamas over here, you know what I mean? And really, it was like that. Like, they'd take the brightest minds, they'd put all their money into it, and they'd go send search parties to India to find the greatest meditator, you know. And it was very consciously done. It was very interesting. So they go to Tibet, they find Kamala Sheila, they say, go to India, come back to Tibet and teach us how to meditate. So he comes. At the same time, there's a scholar from China named Huasheng, and he's coming to Tibet, and he's already been teaching this kind of meditation to Tibetans. It's called Qiyang Say, Jiyang Me.
Jiyang Me.
Jiyang Me means nothing at all. Okay? And he came to Tibet and taught people, you know, the way to meditate is Jiyang Me. You know, sit down, close your eyes, and try to think of nothing. Okay? And I remember the first meditation I went to when I was in college, and I heard about this place, and I went, it was off, I had to walk like a half a mile, it was in some neighborhood, I'll never forget, and there was a house, and there's a guy sitting there, and he's like some dressed up funny, and he says, okay, we're going to learn to meditate. And I go in, and he says, okay, sit down like this, and he says, close your eyes. I close my eyes, and he says, now think about nothing, you know. And I tried really hard to think about nothing, you know, but it's hard to think about nothing. This is called Qiyang Me. This is a a belief about meditation. And I think it kind of went through America and it kind of died out now, or maybe not. But it's the belief that you should sit down and try to think about nothing, and that this is some kind of good meditation. Kamala Sheila heard this was being taught, and he went to the king and he said, he proposed a debate. He said, take the Chinese master, let me debate him in public for 10 days, 15 days, 20 days, as long as it takes. And then let the people decide what kind of meditation they want to do in Tibet. You know, so this was big stakes. In ancient India, you had debates in the court of the king, and whoever won, would be the religion of the whole country. It's like having a Catholic and a Baptist debate on TV, and then you cast votes over the internet or something, and then that becomes the religion of the whole country. This was the system in those days. Okay, so big stakes, big stakes. Kamala Sheila gets into the debate with Huasheng. Now, Kamala Shila, what he's saying is meditation. He's proposing three kinds of meditation. Say jogom.
Jogom.
Jogom. Okay. Gom means meditation. Jog means fixation. You fix the mind on an object. Okay. And this is your, you know, this is what you think of when they say meditation. By the way, it can be an idea or it can be a picture. Okay. It can be like you, the classic one to start with, you picture some enlightened being in the room with you. You know, you close your eyes. And you imagine, you try to imagine very hard His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Jesus or whoever you want, it doesn't matter. But you try to get their face right, you try to get their eyes right, you try to get their mouth right, you try to get their hair right. And and it's like fixing your mind on it. We do this in our everyday lives. Like when you're reading a book, you're doing a jogom. You see, because the book is generating pictures in your mind. Like, I don't know about you, but when you're reading a really good book, you already have some pictures in your mind of how it goes. You know, like it's describing a forest, and in your mind you're seeing some kind of a forest. Okay, that's a jogom. When you're sitting there thinking about your girlfriend, you know, and how she looks and stuff like that, and you're like spacing out a little bit, that's a jogom. Okay, that is a real jogom. When you're thinking about somebody at work that you don't particularly like, that's a jogom. You know, you fixed your mind on them. That's a jogom. Okay, so we do, every creature, by the way, according to Buddhism, every living creature has some ability to concentrate. It's one of the 5 or 10 mental functions that all creatures enjoy. An amoeba, an ant, a caterpillar, you know, has the ability to concentrate for a brief second. And that's a kind of gom. You have ting and zin. You have the capacity of concentration. So jogom is like you develop it, you know, and you get to where you can close your eyes and concentrate and see something clearly. Great musicians do it with sounds. Great artists do it with images before they paint them. You know, great sculptors, Michelangelo sees the thing before he starts doing the sculpture. He sees it in his mind's eye. So this is your mind's eye. That's jogom, okay? But notice they all have an object. You see what I mean? Whether it's a picture or an idea or a sound, there's an object, okay? And Buddhism teaches that the mind always has an object, okay? You cannot have a state of consciousness that doesn't have an object, okay? It can be trying to think of nothing, but that becomes the object. You see what I mean? So the idea that you can have a state of mind without an object is according to Buddhism false. The word for mind is yulchen in Buddhism, which means that thing which grasps onto an object. And according to Buddhism, it takes an object to generate a state of mind. To trigger a state of mind, you must have an object. So to say that you could think of nothing is impossible. Nothing becomes an object. You see what I mean? Trying to think of nothing, the thought to think of nothing, watching your mind and watching your thoughts becomes an object itself. So this is what Kamala Shila starts out with. By the way, when they talk about meditating on emptiness, that's jogong. Pure, sheer emptiness. But that kind of emptiness is a very specific lack of some kind of quality. And it's not just thinking about nothing. So you have to remember that. It's never that. That's not what meditating on emptiness means. Okay? First kind of meditation. Second kind. Say shargom.
Shargom.
Shargom. Shargom is a special kind of meditation where you review a number of steps of an idea. For example, you might review how to set up your room for a meditation, which is what we're going to study later on tonight or next class. Okay, what are the steps that you go through when you want to start a meditation? It's very interesting that according to Buddhism, you can't meditate properly without warming up first. They say it's very similar to jogging or running or anything like that. You have to do a special warm-up process. And when they teach you to meditate in a Tibetan monastery, they sit you down. You don't meditate for days and days. First they tell you, this is how you get ready to meditate. You have to go through this warm-up, this warm-up, this warm-up, this warm-up, and they go over it over and over again with you before you learn to meditate. They don't let you meditate for quite some time. They want to make sure you have the warm-up right. And they say if you don't do the warm-up right, you'll never be good at meditation. Okay, so you have to learn that. Shargom, you could do a Shargom on the warm-up. You see what I mean? All the steps you have to do to meditate. You could close your eyes and think about, okay, first I do that. Second I do that. Third I do that. Fourth I do that. And that's a Shargom. So Shargom means to review something over and over, like a process or something like that. You can say like a review meditation, whereas Jogom is a fixation meditation. In a fixation meditation, the object doesn't change. The goal is to keep it fixed in front of your mind. In a Shargom, it's like playing cards, you know, and you're seeing them one by one, and then you put them back together and you do it again. And that creates like, I think in science they believe there's something like if a child learns to speak a foreign language, certain links are made in their mind that wouldn't be made otherwise. And after practicing a foreign language for a while, you get certain links in your mind and they stay there. And that's the idea. The idea is that you go over a certain list of ideas 10, 20, 30, 50 times, and then finally it becomes second nature and it's part of your mind and it stays in your mind. By the way, the word dom or meditation in Tibetan means to get used to something, to burn it into your mind. See what I mean? So the idea is it better to meditate on the Washington Monument or on the picture of a Buddha? You see what I mean? Can you just close your eyes and think about the Washington Monument and how high it is and get a picture of that? You know that distinctive shape comes in your mind, right? Like that. And you can close your eyes and anyone in this room has enough gom to imagine that shape. You see what I mean? Or should you start with the outline of a Buddha, you know, or Jesus or something like that? We say start with something that's holy, because whatever you put in front of your mind puts an imprint on your mind. You see, I mean, every time you put your mind on something, you get a little residue of that object stays with you. So better to meditate on something holy, sacred from the beginning, because it rubs off on your mind. Okay, so don't think about the person who irritated you today. Don't gom on that, because a little bit of them will rub off on you by having them as the object of your mind. It's very interesting. The minute you put an object in front of your mind, certain parts of that object infect your mind. So Buddhism says it's very important to, if you're going to meditate, don't pick a neutral object, don't pick somebody you don't like, pick some holy, holy, holy being. Whatever you think is the holiest being in the world. And each person has a different one, maybe. But take that one and fix that. Do your jogom on that. So gom means to, the word for meditation in Buddhism means to get used to something until you burn that imprint into your mind. Okay. What's the third kind of meditation? Say Chegom.
Chegom.
Chegom is a very beautiful kind of meditation. And I think it's what you'll probably do if you try to meditate, whether it's on purpose or not. Okay. Chegom means to take a problem and analyze it. Chegom is analytical meditation. The problem can be, why does this person at work doesn't like me? You know, why is it they don't like me? And then you'll go through all the reasoning. You say, well, you know, I did say something to them the other day. You know, well, you know, we did bump into each other. You know, well. And then you start to think of all the reasons why this person doesn't like you. And then towards the end of the meditation, you're like, I get it. I know why they don't like me. You know, and you make a decision. Okay, that's Chegom. So a good Buddhist Chegom would be, you know, is it important to do my Buddhism quickly, or do I have time? You know, should I take it sort of at an easy pace, or should I get fanatical about it? You know, Well, you know, there's pros and cons. Fanatical people tend to burn out and quit after a while. On the other hand, about 5 of my friends have died already, got hit by cars when they least expected it. And I really should get ready, you know. Then again, most of my friends haven't died. Then again, the ones who did die really didn't think they were going to die either. You know, and then you go through this, it's called a chegom. That's a good chegom, that's called chivamitapa, that's a death meditation. And you go through all the pros and cons about, you know, do I have some time left or don't I have some time left, you know. Is there a place where am I more likely to die on the street or in my house? You know, is it safer in my house than in the street, you know? You know what, when I think about it, all the stuff I eat could kill me just as well as a car. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just as likely that I'll have a heart attack unexpectedly as I will getting run over, so it doesn't really matter whether I'm inside or outside. I'm just as likely to die. When the time comes, I'll die, you know? And it could be a car kills me, or it could be my heart kills me. Or it could be the roof kills me, you know, but something will kill me. Oftentimes, the things that you use to live kill you. You see what I mean? Like a doctor kills you, or medicine kills you, or food kills you. Many people have been killed by food, sitting at the table, you know. Seriously. So that's a chegom. You know, you're trying to decide whether to go to class tonight. And you're doing a chegom. You know, what are the odds that I won't die before the next class, you know? And I have time, you know. I've had many students sitting in your seat who've died, trust me. Okay, I'm not kidding. There was this beautiful man, Thelma's friend, we just got a letter. She had sent him a correspondence course because he went out to New Mexico to meet his friends and he never got it. Okay, he died. And he was waiting for the correspondence course. Luckily, it was on time. I mean, what I mean is we didn't send it 6 months late like we usually do. So we didn't feel so bad. But what I mean is it's going to come. You know, people didn't expect it. I've had students die. We started a 5-year course 5 years ago and now a certain number of those people are dead. You know, you don't know. You just don't know. And that's a chegom. To go through that discussion in your own mind is a chegom. Okay? And then to decide by the end of that chegom, you know what? I'll take care of my spiritual needs now, and later if I have some extra time, I'll take care of my material needs. Instead of the other way around. It makes more sense. You know, if I die with money, it doesn't help. If I die with some spiritual realizations, it does help. So you know what? I'll take care of the spiritual stuff first, and then later I'll get rich. You know what I mean? It's just a logical way to do it. But if you never chegom about it, you'll never do it. You know? Because you just kind of roll with your life, right? Yeah. I can't hear you. Somebody can tell me? You mean as opposed to an angry state of mind or something like that? We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it. We'll get to that. Okay? What you're asking is what state of mind to go into a meditation, what state of mind you'll come out of in a meditation. We're going to talk about that a lot. Okay? Maybe we'll talk about it right now. Okay? I guess I want to talk about first is the, you know, what's the use of meditating? Why should you meditate? By the way, this is what the class is about. This chapter in the garden, by the way, you're going to get 2 classes on meditation. This chapter in the garden is where the guy is learning how to meditate. And I don't know about you, I don't know what your first impressions of meditation were, but mine were also uninformed. You know, I was not well educated about meditation. I thought I could meditate. You know, I saw Kung Fu on TV and everything. And I thought, I'm supposed to, you know, that's your exposure of a normal American to meditation. Somehow, you're supposed to sit still. Your legs are supposed to be crossed in some kind of way that makes you very uncomfortable. You know, you're supposed to look very serious and deep, you know, and if your head's kind of shavy, that's better. And you're supposed to think about nothing. And then when you get up, you're very calm, and when they attack you with sticks and stuff, you can just, you know, and then still smile to the guy afterwards, you know. And that's, no, really, that's what America thinks, you know, that's the way it was presented to me. And I believed that for a long time. So what is the real reason to meditate? Is it to get to a point where you become very, what they call equanimity? Meditative equipoise. I like that one. Is it that you're supposed to reach a point where you're supposed to not care about anything? You see what I mean? Like someone can spit on you or someone can give you a medal and you still feel the same. You see what I mean? Is that the point of meditation? Are you just supposed to get to a point where you can just kind of space out and nothing bothers you? And then, you know, you get old, it's okay. It doesn't bother you. You get rich, it doesn't bother you. You get broke, it doesn't bother you. Somebody hits you on the head with a brick, it doesn't bother you. Is that the point of meditation? Is that the goal of meditation? You see what I mean? And these are all like misconceptions about meditation that I was exposed to as a normal American. Time magazine, New York Times, television, you know, these are the myths about meditation that you've been fed. Okay, so what is the point of meditating? Why meditate? And how much meditation is enough? And what's the use of it? I think the first one we can call something. Say something.
Something.
I'm going to start going through the benefits of meditation. You know, what's the use of meditating? First one is something. Something means a general meditative state of mind that you carry around the whole day. Okay? Like if you meditate in the morning, and I usually tell people half an hour, 45 minutes is a good start. If you meditate that much in the morning, and if you do it every day, you will start to reach a state of something. And something is like a heightened awareness of things, okay? Like, as you go through the day, your mind is brighter, your mind is happier, you're generally on an even keel. Things don't bother you as much. Life becomes better. Actually, your health improves, okay? Your whole body starts to change, and your mind, and you're more calm. This is the, like a general feeling meditative all day, contemplative all day long, you know. And I don't mean spacey, okay? You can still work in an office, you know, you can still do some kind of job that requires constant attention, but your general level of peacefulness is heightened, and you go through the whole day being much more calm, much more capable, and the whole day is like on an even keel. And this is one benefit of meditation. Okay, if you get into real meditation, it flows through the day. It's not like you meditate from 8 to 9 and then you don't meditate from 9 to 8. It's like the meditation stretches into your whole day, and your whole day becomes a different level, and your mind is calm, your feelings are calm, you're able to go through the day with some kind of happier atmosphere. And that's a general feeling of something. Okay, first benefit. Say Tingenzin. Tingenzin. Tingenzin means the ability to delve into an object, okay? And it's especially useful for problems, okay? I did business I was in the corporate world for 16 years, every day, doing business. And I had a large department to run. We had offices overseas, many workers. It was in the diamond business. And we did 30,000 diamonds a day in that department. And what, you know, in any operation which you're trying to get supplies from overseas and you're negotiating the price of a thing that has no value, that's worthless, you know what I mean? It's not like buying steel or something like that. Like every time you buy one, there's an argument because it depends on how bad you want it, because there's no price for a diamond. Diamonds, you can't eat diamonds, you can't drive diamonds. They're worthless. They're little rocks. They're even so hard, they're not much use for anything, you know? So it's a special kind of thing where you are constantly faced with problems. You know, J.C. Penney wants 3,000 of this kind of diamond. You have to go all over the whole world on your phone and try to find it. And then each person you talk to, there's going to be a negotiation and a fight and an argument and terms and conditions and shipping and coordination of 10,000 stones coming in by April 3rd for this order that's going to be in the newspaper on a certain day with nothing in the store. I mean, this happens, you know? So you're constantly having to solve problems. You'd be on the phone with four or five people in different countries at the same time. It's like a stock market or something. But if you have Tingen Zen, you can just cut through everything, you know? I mean, Tingen Zen you can use for anything. Tingen Zen is like this special ability to cut right down into a problem and see the solution immediately. It's very interesting. It's almost a steel quality of the mind, you know, where you're just able to focus on that and delve into it, see the end of the problem, and execute it. So then obviously, I mean, if you're interested in getting rich, it's very useful. Okay, it really is, and there's no problem with getting rich. Getting rich is fine. The question is what you do with it. Okay, there's no problem. Bodhisattvas are supposed to get money so they can help people, and they're supposed to spend it all quickly. Okay, so you get this special ability to see into a problem and solve it, and that's a second quality of meditation. What I'm trying to say is, a person who is meditating regularly, their life will be much, much smoother. Why? A, all day long you feel better. B, that's the something. B, you have Tingen Zen, which means every time a problem comes up, much more quickly than other people, you see an obvious good solution, and it's finished. You know, and people are still trying to figure it out. People who are not meditating can sit there for a couple hours and not see what you see. You see what I mean? I've been with a lama in a car who never saw a car engine before. And the car broke down. And we open the lid, you know, the trunk, hood, and we're looking in. That's how much I know about cars. So he's looking in, and he says, "Tell me what this little box here, you know." He says, "It's a battery." He says, "What's that for?" I said, "Oh, it connects over there." And after about 5 minutes, he says, "The problem's right here. Fix this thing, you know." And he was right, you know. And it's a Tingen Zen, and I'm not kidding. I mean, a person who's really meditating well, whether it's business or relationships or anything else, you immediately see insights that other people don't have. So even if there's no nirvana and enlightenment, it's still worth it to meditate. It's very interesting. Very, very good for your mind. Okay? Third one. Say Xinjiang.
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 Xinjiang is a very beautiful thing. There's a mental one, and there's a physical one. And it's a very hard word to translate. Xinjiang means, when my Lama, he always teaches it the same way. He says, what's this guy's in the Olympics? He'll say, you know, the Chinese people are good at that too, you know. They jump up on that bar and they flip over and then they jump backwards and they go like this and they can bend every which way, and that's Xinjiang. Okay, Xinjiang means some kind of agility of the body and mind. What's that? Yeah, it's like gymnastics. But it's the ability to move quickly, lightly, fluently, joyfully. And to feel good about it. Sometimes I say pliancy or something like that, but it just means that you can go and land on your feet, you know. And if you start meditating regularly, you start to get two versions of Xinjiang, mental and physical. Meaning, this is very interesting. I'll teach you some tantra. It's secret, okay? Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody I told you. You have a central channel running from here down to there, okay? And it comes down your back, and it comes up, and it comes to here. And it starts here. And it's invisible. You can't see it. If you cut your body open, you'll never find it. It's like a spiritual backbone that you have. It's like a straw, and it has certain energies moving through it. Every time you have a good thought, a wholesome thought, a certain kind of energy comes down, up and down that channel. And it has a certain good effect on your body. You see what I mean? Like it has a very subtle connection to your body. This is, by the way, the ultimate connection between body and mind. So if you think certain kinds of wholesome thoughts, compassionate thoughts, pure-minded thoughts, then certain energies are passing through your body, and then your body begins to change in a very subtle way. And the more you have those thoughts, the more you feel better physically. So the first kind of Xinjiang, if you're meditating frequently, there's a very beautiful thing about meditation, big advantage to meditation, called Samten Gi Domba. Say Samten
Ki
Domba. Samten Gi
Domba.
This is called the vow of meditation. Okay, the vow of meditation. And the principle is this. A normal human being, out of 100 of thoughts that you have in your mind, about 90 are negative. Okay? And I'm not saying you're thinking to kill the person next to you, although you may be, I don't know. But there's just this little negative thoughts going on all the time. Like, I don't feel well. I wish this wasn't, weren't going to have this meeting tomorrow. You know, I didn't have such a good dinner. You know, that person's bothering me. I wonder if they're going to fire me at work. You know, all these thoughts are circulating in your mind. And then about every fifth or sixth thought, you have a nice thought. You see what I mean? So on the whole, you're constantly running out of karmic negative. All right. When you're in meditation, the situation reverses. You see what I mean? Like, when you're in deep meditation, you can't have very bad thoughts, or you wouldn't be in meditation. You see, they ruin your meditation. You'd pop out of meditation. You know, when you're having a pretty good meditation, you can't be thinking about how someone, you'd like to kill them or something like that. So the more you meditate, the more good karma you collect automatically. And then your body starts to change. You see what I mean? And so your body will get lighter and lighter. If you meditate regularly for a while, your body would start to feel the way it used to feel when you were 20-something. You see what I mean? It's very interesting. If you meditate on a regular basis, there's this tantric thing. It starts to actually change your physical body. The purity of your thoughts starts to change your body. And it's the same is true with your mind. Okay? Your mind starts to feel lighter. You're able to go through somersaults mentally and come down on your feet. Nothing upsets you much. Nothing disturbs you much. You're able to go through very complicated thought processes and land on your feet and be calm and collected and happy. Okay? And that's called Xinjiang. So people who meditate more, physically they feel better, and then mentally they feel better. It's some kind of... you feel younger, mentally and physically, and you start acting different. You can physically do things you couldn't do 5 years ago. Okay? Your whole body changes. And this is good if you have some kind of illness or things. If you have a chronic bone problem, back problem, things like that, it's very good for that. It will change. Okay? That's called Xinjiang. Next one. Say shine.
Shine.
In Sanskrit, this is called shamatha. Okay, shamatha. Shine means, I mean, the word means quiescence or quietude or something. She means peace. Mental quietude or mental quiet or something like that. It doesn't have much to do with that, all right? It doesn't mean sham, which means peace. It's a very interesting thing. Shamatha is when you get good at meditating, you're able to see other realms that other people are not able to see. Okay? So you can think of the reality as bandwidth, you know what I mean? Like you can think of reality as some kind of you know how they say that there's this many kinds of light? I mean, it goes from infrared into X-ray or something like that. And then the visible spectrum is like here to here. And I don't know, red is over here and blue is over here. And then the light gets too short, the wavelengths get too short and you can't see them anymore. Or they get too long and you can't see them anymore. And your eyes are limited to this visible spectrum. You know, what happens with shine is that it expands. You know, your visible spectrum becomes something like that. And you're able to detect other levels of reality that you're not aware of now. Okay? It's very interesting. You could think of it as like a door that leads into a hallway or something like that. And if you never meditate, you'll never see those wavelengths. It's very interesting. I mean, there are people who go through their entire lives to 70 years. They live a whole human life of 70 years long without meditating, and they don't even know that there are other realities right around them all the time, and they were there all the time, and they never saw them. I mean, it's very possible, if you don't meditate regularly, you'll truly believe there's no such thing. You won't believe that these areas even exist, okay? And that's... Shine is the increase in your bandwidth, you know? Shine, shamatha, means you're now able to see other kinds of reality. Very, very, very interesting. If you think about it, the odds are very likely that there are thousands of realities. You see what I mean? You've been living one. You've been on one level of consciousness. And what's cool is that there are literally thousands of other levels. You know, there are many, many other levels that you can get to if you meditate regularly. And if you don't, you'll never, ever see them. You see what I mean? They can only be seen by a person who's in deep meditation. Okay? So very interesting. There are many, many levels. And by the way, to see your future lives, for example, is not such a big deal. You know, it's like to move out to this level of meditation. I mean, once you get good at meditating, things like that, you can see easily. You can see directly. It's not such a big deal. If you would meditate regularly, you would see them. Okay, and if you don't meditate regularly, you'll never see them. It's very interesting. There are all these other things going on around you, whole different levels of reality, beautiful, amazing, unbelievable things going on right around you, and you're not able to see them because you don't meditate. Okay, and as soon as you start to meditate regularly, that width, that bandwidth starts to expand. Very weird things start to happen. Beautiful things. Okay, like at about here, you can remember everything that happened to you in your past life, and everything you ever learned in your past life. You know, get out to about here, and you can fly or walk on water. Seriously. Okay, get out to about here, and you can see your own enlightenment in the future, and enjoy it, and think about it. You know, meet enlightened beings. You know, all those things are happening out here, and you can't see them unless you meditate. You have to learn to meditate. Okay, must learn to meditate. I'll say one more thing about meditation. We'll take a break, and then I'll actually start giving you the background on how to meditate. All right. Right now, I'm just a salesman. I'm trying to convince you that it's useful to try. Okay. I mean, all these sexy things really happen. I think in Buddhism, you know, in the scriptures, they say people don't meditate because they don't realize all this stuff. Nobody ever told them all this stuff. So they're not like, if someone wants to meditate, it's for some vague feeling that they'll feel better if they meditate. It's not like that. You can go to worlds that you never imagined if you learn to meditate, because you have to learn to meditate. And even if there's no other worlds, you go to work, you get rich fast, I'm telling you. You know? And I'm not kidding. Whatever you do, even your personal relationships with your family and stuff, immediately will get better, because your mind is clearer, sharper, cleaner. And I speak from, you know, Forbes magazine, I'm not bragging, okay, came to interview me. They said, how did you do that? You know, we started with 3 people, we ended with 1,000 people. How did you do that? I said, well, part of it is meditation, you know. You learn to concentrate, and you learn to focus, and then... You know, if that's what you want, and by the way, it's not a bad thing to be comfortable and to be able to help other people. You know what I mean? That's fine. There's no problem with that. As long as it's honest, right? Get some money and use it. You know, spend it. And I did. All of it. but you can do it. It's very useful. Even if there's no such thing as Buddhahood and all that, which there is, Nirvana. To learn to meditate and make your whole life run a lot smoother, and you'll be able to do things. Creativity, forget it, you know. I mean, total sense of creativity that you never knew you were capable of. Want to paint something, want to write a book, want to write some music, anything. Make a play. I mean, everything, easy. It just comes to you. You see what I mean? But you got to learn to meditate. Last thing I'll say about meditation, we'll take a break then, and then I'll answer some questions when we get back, okay? To meditate well, and not many people talk about this, but this is very, very important in meditation. To meditate well, you have to have a clean conscience. Okay? And a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, I've been trying to meditate for 3 years now and it doesn't work very well. I didn't get any of this other spectrum you're talking about, okay? And my job is actually going pretty bad. Okay? And stuff like that. And I say, examine your life in terms of what we call ethical living, you know, because this is the primary fuel for meditation. Your conscience must be totally clear. You see what I mean? You can't be doing anything sneaky or harmful or a little bit improper to other people. You can't be leading a life which impinges on other people in a bad way and still expect to meditate. It will never work, okay? You got to clean up your act, okay? And I'm not saying you're evil and you're out murdering people at night and stuff like that. I'm just saying, like, do you gossip regularly? You know, do you kind of wish that the people next to you at work would fail or get fired? You know, do you sometimes use the boss's phone and not tell them? You know, do you use the photocopier for your Buddhism classes? Without, you know, stuff like that. It's this low. It's continual small bad deeds. You see, it's those gray. What do you call it? Gray areas. That ruin your meditation. You will not be able to meditate well unless you purify that gray area. I don't believe there's anybody in here embezzling thousands of dollars from their company. There may be one or two. I don't believe you go out and mug people at night or stuff like that. That's not what ruins your meditation. Probably be better than the what we call low-level radiation, which means constant, continual sort of fudging stuff. You see what I mean? Like, you kind of have an affair going on with somebody, or, you know, you kind of lied to your boss last week, or, you know, you kind of weren't frank with people exactly. You know, you didn't lie about the contract, but you didn't quite tell them about those three things at the bottom, and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And that kind of fudging, what do you call it? It strips your meditation of any power. Say ngar. Ngar. It's impossible, right? Ngar means a certain kind of intensity to meditation. Ngar is used in Tibet for kinds of steel that if they have ngar, you can put a good blade on them, and if they don't have ngar, you can't put a good blade on them. It's called temper, I think. But ngar means some kind of deep power, intensity to your meditation. You can't have that if you're living any kind of gray, if there are any kind of gray areas in your behavior during the day. Okay, that's what I'm trying to say. Ethically, a Buddhist who wants to meditate seriously has to be, you know, check, straight person. Siddhi, you know, saint in Tibetan, is a person who's living a very straight life. Very straight, okay? And it doesn't mean Mahatma Gandhi, okay? It means just simply, I refuse to cheat on my taxes. I refuse to tell small lies to people. You know, I refuse to misrepresent things to my friends. You know, I'm going to keep my eyes where they should be during the day and not something improper. And those little decisions, then when you go to meditate, boom, it's incredible. You know, the meditation goes like, unbelievable. So if you're having kind of sluggish meditation, think about that. You know, and I'm not talking about that you're stealing money from people. I'm talking little ethical fudges that you do. Okay, you clean those up, and your meditation will take off. Okay, one question. Then
when you come back to talking about how to meditate, we talk about when stress can be to concentrate on analytical meditation to solve a problem or something you're trying to understand. Not to
free
your mind of thought or let the thoughts pass.
Yeah.
Rather than stopping
to think. He said when you come back, okay, will you talk about, you know, there's times when you should be trying to crack a problem with your mind, and there's times to lay off. And that's actually two of the problems. There's a certain number of typical problems that you'll encounter meditating. One is failing to put your mind on something when you should. Later on, you get a problem called overdoing it. And that's when you should back off and take your mind off the object a little bit. Yeah, so we'll talk about that. Okay, so have some refreshments. Come back in about 10 minutes, okay? Two more small announcements, okay? As you may know or not know, after this year's courses, I'm planning to do a 3-year silent retreat. That will take place in Arizona, where I grew up. And we have a person who has donated a large piece of property there to build something on. And we're going to be out there building some retreat cabins out of adobe and things like that for long-term people retreating, like from 6-week retreats up to 3-year retreats. Okay, so there'll be a crew of people traveling between Arizona and here during the coming year to get that ready, and then people will be starting to do long retreats there. It's a very, very beautiful place south of Tucson in a mountain. It's a national park. It's at the base of a national park, and a very beautiful piece of property in high desert. So it's very interesting. It's a very beautiful place. It's a very empty place. And it's about 50 to 80 degrees all year long. It's just a very weird plateau next to a mountain. And then twice a year, I'll be coming out for 3-week teachings there. There's some very beautiful natural amphitheaters in the stone that the Indians used to use. And the National Park Service has said we can have them to use. And so there'll be like very intense teachings twice a year for 3 weeks, okay, of which you're welcome to attend a part of it or all of it as you like. People will be encouraged to come out and do meditation on their own, whether it's in a tent or we're going to Mongolia to check out yurts, and or whether you want to build a small adobe place, but it's enough property that people can do that. So we're also planning after that process to resume classes here about 6 months a year, and then 6 months a year to start a university there modeled after the old Mongolian Buddhist universities. In Mongolia, we went there and they taught us. You know, I went through the Geshe course. It takes 18 years of philosophical studies. And then usually you just graduate and then go do your tantric practice or something like that. In Mongolia, you were expected to go to medical school and become a Tibetan doctor after finishing the 18 years. And then after that, you're expected to go to the dance college and become a dancer, a sacred dance, and you know, a 5-year study or 6-year study. And then you're expected to become a musician, and then you're expected to learn sculpture and painting. And so we want to revive that custom in the United States. And we're starting a university there of 8 colleges to do that kind of study program there. And we have some old masters from Mongolia and Tibet, India, who are coming to live there and teach there. So if you're interested in talking about that or being involved with it, it doesn't matter. I mean, you could do something at the hardware store in New York, or you could come out there and live for a year and build something. It doesn't matter. But if it's something that sounds attractive to you or you'd like to be involved with it, we'll have a meeting this Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. At the 6th Street Temple, which is 321 East 6th Street. It's between 1st and 2nd, okay, avenues. And you're very welcome to come. It's just an open meeting. We're going to lay out, show people what it looks like, how to get there, what kind of things that people could pitch in and help with and stuff like that. We're thinking even like people who want to do stained glass, people who can do carpentry, people who like mud to do adobe, you know, people who like to keep records, finance, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So if you have any kind of desire to get involved with that, you're quite welcome to come and help with that, all right? Monday night at, 5:30 to 6, in my room. People come over there all the time and hang out. Like on any given night, we maybe have 20 people hanging out there. Seriously. And we split some project and we do it. Like we just worked on a CD-ROM of ancient Buddhist texts, or we're doing, you know, like research on the net about Arizona snakes and stuff like that. So if you want to come and just be there, every Monday night we organize it for the whole week, and we could give you a job that you can go do, and it's cool. It's a very fun group, and we meet there every night and we do something together, and we eat Thai food and stuff like that. Okay, we'll continue now with the meditation. In the story that you're going to get tonight, to put in your notebook, the young man is in the garden. Kamala Shila strolls in. He's expecting this handsome, tall Dalai Lama type with, intense concentration and serene and severe. And instead, it turns out to be this roly-poly little guy who's giggling all the time. And he's saying, okay, let's meditate, man. And then he says, okay, let's meditate. And he gets down, and they start to try to meditate. And this guy keeps jumping up and disturbing him and making fun of him and saying, wait a minute, you're doing that wrong, or you don't know how to do that, or they didn't teach you that in school. And during the process of this kind of a funny encounter between the jolly guy and the serious student, right, you get to hear all the methods of meditation. Okay, so what I want you to know is that while you're reading that simple little story, you're getting Kamala Shila's presentation exactly. So it's not just a story, and you have to study the reading, okay? And all the parts of meditation will be there. What most people don't know about is that you need to warm up to meditate properly. It's very much like running, jogging, or dancing, or any kind of exercise. It requires a very intense warm up. And I think Americans often fail in meditation for two reasons. Either they aren't aware that your whole day has to be clean ethically, that you have to have a clean state of mind to meditate, or they don't know how to warm up. They don't know the warm-up process. So we're going to go through the warm-up process, all right? And these are different things that you need to do to warm up for meditation properly, okay? Say chingwa.
Chingwa.
Chingwa. Chingwa is it means dullness, okay? A dull state of mind. And I'll describe it for you. There's a subtle dullness and a gross dullness. I'm talking about gross dullness. It's brought on by a couple of factors. One is food. Okay? And what this means is if you want to be a good meditator in the morning from 7 to 8 o'clock, there's certain other behavior you have to do all day long to be a good meditator. Okay, so it's not enough to sit down all straight and handsome and sit, and look like Kung Fu or something for an hour. There's certain kinds of behavior that you have to go all day long to learn to meditate properly. One is to avoid chingwa all day long. You see what I mean? Don't overeat the whole day. Okay, and especially don't overeat before meditating. Okay? In other words, you have to get in the habit of controlling your food intake. If you want to be a good meditator, you have to become, what do you call it? The Greeks called it nothing in excess, You have to learn to lead a simple life as far as your food intake, You can't like pig out the night before and expect a good meditation the next morning. That's what I'm trying to say. The food may be digested already, and you may feel pretty good. But it has this effect on you called chingwa, and it makes you dull, and you won't be able to meditate well. So if you're having a trouble meditating and you don't know quite why, and you feel like sometimes sleepy or a little dull or something like that, try to watch your food intake. Okay, the whole day. Okay, we're also talking caffeine, sugar, stuff like that. You can have coffee the afternoon before meditation, and then sleep, and then get up the next morning, and it will still be affecting you. You see what I mean? And if you like a good cup of coffee, and I do, and I have two every morning, I think, before meditation. Anyway, Try to cut it down. That's all. If you go into retreat, you have to cut it out completely. Okay, but that's another story. But in general, try to lower the intake of sugar, carbohydrates, coffee, like that. Otherwise, you'll get chingwa. Okay. The other one is sleep. Obviously, if you sleep too much, you'll get lazy and stupid and you won't be able to meditate. But I'm talking about the opposite. A lot of people that I know don't sleep enough. And this is a big enemy for meditation. You cannot meditate well if you're not well rested. Okay, and many Americans I know have tried to meditate very sincerely. You know, they put in the time, they learned all the preliminaries, they did everything right, the seat was right, the posture was right, and everything else. But something's wrong, something's not clicking, something's always going wrong during their meditation. And oftentimes, it's not enough sleep, and you're not even aware of it. You see what I mean? Sometimes, it's just no ngar. There's no intensity to your meditation. Like, okay, I can sit for an hour, and my head doesn't nod that much, you know? But something's missing. Like, I don't have any bite. I don't have any intensity to my meditative experience. It's often due to a lack of sleep. Okay, you have to be rested nicely. Okay, exercise. And for that, it's something like you could try yoga or running or dancing or anything that Tai Chi is good, but anything that gets your body moving. If your channels are a little bit open, which happens when you're, and I'm not talking weightlifting every day, okay? I'm just talking like an hour's walk a day or something like that. This keeps your body very good for meditation. So these are all the physical constraints on your body. Your body has to be in pretty good health to meditate well. By the way, that's also the urgency of the practice. You have to meditate before your body gives out, and it will. Okay, so you have to start now. Frankly, once you get to a certain age, it's much harder to meditate and much more difficult to get into a deep state of meditation. The scriptures say it's possible, but it's difficult. You know, if you try hard, you can do it. But why wait? You know, might as well do it now. So learn to meditate now and get good at it. Okay, so that's the first one. Second one is gupa. Gupa means to have like a distracted state of mind. Okay, the word gu in Tibetan, when you connect it to the word for human, becomes the word for gorilla or chimpanzee. Okay, so gupa means like, you know, like that. And what it means when you're meditating is, by the way, I'm not talking about the hour you're meditating, I'm talking about the 23 hours you're out of meditation. The Buddhist books say you have to pay attention to your lifestyle in order to be a good meditator. So oftentimes what makes the difference between successful meditation or a failure in your meditation is how you live the other 23 hours. So gupa means that you don't tie up your life with too much activities. All right? And this is totally a matter of capacity. Okay? Like some people can't handle more than one or two activities. Some people can easily handle 50. You see what I mean? But you have to judge what you can take. In other words, keep your life within your capacity. You shouldn't have more things going on than you can do well. And if you do, it'll damage your meditation. Okay? If your lifestyle is frenetic, don't expect to be able to sit down for an hour and meditate well. By the way, it can be busy, but not frenetic. You see what I mean? Like, bodhisattvas are very famous. There's a clear distinction made in the scriptures between a hermit monk and a bodhisattva monk. You know, like a hermit monk is trying to live quietly in a little corner in a cell in a mountain cave or something like that. Bodhisattva monk has 14 projects that they're doing, you know, and that's fine. You see, there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay to be busy as long as it's within your capacity. Once you get out of your capacity, it will damage your meditation. So that you have to judge on your own, okay? That's a whole state of mind, and it's a way that you live your life that you have to work on, okay? Next one is gyupa. By the way, the source for these is Nagarjuna. 200 AD, 1700 years ago. Say Gyopa.
Gyopa.
Gyopa. If you know Tibetan, Gyopa normally means regret. Here it has nothing to do with regret. It's called thinking about the good old days. Okay? Thinking about the good old days, not living in the present. All right? And this is a special damage to meditation. Okay? It's where you spend any significant part of the day thinking about things that used to be, things that could have been, things that might be tomorrow. You know what I mean? It's the habit of not living in the present time. Baba Ram Das would say, be here now, right? And it's that concept. You think too much about how healthy you used to be. You think too much about that business you could have had. You think too much about that person you used to live with or something like that. And you refuse to put your mind in the present. And then equally, you put it into the future. You're constantly thinking about things you're going to do or could do or might do or something like that. By the way, it's not bad to do a Chögyam, an analytical meditation about your future. You have to. But to sit there and make up plans and wishes and could-bes and might-bes is recognized in the scriptures as a special thing that will damage your meditation. Okay, so you have to get in the habit of dealing with the present and being in the present time, okay? And that's a special obstruction to meditation, to not do that, okay? Next one is called Duyen.
Duyen.
This is short for Dupe Yunden. Dupe Yunden means object of the senses. Okay? Object of the senses. And there's a list, okay? I mean, people say, I had a lady today interviewing me, right, about this book she's writing, and she's like, Buddhism is behind the times because it's hung up on the idea that the body is bad or sinful or dirty. And things like sex are, in Buddhism, are all wrong, and therefore Buddhism is archaic, and they don't recognize that there can be some joy and happiness and beauty in the body. And the same with music and other things, you know. And then I said, it's not really like that. You see, I think Buddhism would more say, you have to enjoy things in a moderate way. You see what I mean? And when you start to excess in things, it will disturb your meditation. Okay, so the first thing, like something like music, okay? Is music sinful? You know, do Buddhist monks ever listen to Neil Young? It's not the point. I mean, it's not the point of Buddhism to try to make your life as boring as possible. You know what I mean? It's not the point. If you meditate well, and then you go listen to music, you'll hear things you never heard before. You see what I mean? The point is not to listen to music all day that it starts to invade your meditation. You see what I mean? That when you get down and when you get silent, that all you can hear is Neil Young. You see what I mean? There's a distinction. If you meditate well, and if you become a good Buddhist, you'll be able to listen to a song and really, really enjoy it. You see what I mean? But I'm talking about background blabber music, you know, that's on the radio, you're not listening to it, and it's invading your brain, and then when you sit down to meditate, because you listened to 3 hours of useless talk and music on the radio the day before, your meditation is lousy, and you don't know why. You know, like you say, I don't know, my posture's right, the room's quiet, I didn't overeat this morning, but still can't concentrate. You know, it's because of the 2 days ago you listened to 3 hours of useless music. I mean, I'm talking about background blabber music or talk radio, stuff like that, okay? So is it sinful? No. Is beautiful music enjoyable? Of course. I saw His Holiness at a concert. I was sitting behind him. What's his name? Richie Havens came out. And he's saying, you know, Woodstock generation, if you're my age, okay? He played Freedom. And I was watching His Holiness to see if he would move, you know, and he was like, you know, going like that, you know, and obviously he's enjoying the music, you know, but the point is he's not like letting it infect his mind by listening to babble music for a couple hours, and then when you try to meditate, you don't know why you can't concentrate, even 2-3 days later, okay? So you have to be sensitive to that in your life. It's not that music is sinful. When you get to Buddha paradise, there'll be music all the time. I'm sure it'll be Neil Young. But at least in mine, okay? It's not the point. It's beautiful. It is a beautiful thing. But the point is not to let it to disturb your meditation, okay? And it will, okay? Next thing is like talk. And depends on if you're in a retreat, it's good to be totally silent. Even if you just want to be a good meditator, it's good not to get into long talks that have no goal. You see what I mean? Like talks when you're just sitting and talking to talk. And then a lot of Americans, and me included, will just talk to hear themselves talk. And what happens is 2 or 3 days later, you try to meditate, and for some reason you can't concentrate. And that's the effect of blabber. You know, and it will hurt you. TV, I would put in the same category. It's not that TV is evil, and in fact, Master Shantideva would say, "Go watch TV once in a while when you need to relax. You know, when you're totally dumbed out and tired from work. Okay, go listen to the news, just for relaxation. You know, that's a Buddhist method, and it's accepted in Buddhism. But to sit there hour after hour and let it invade your mind, and then 2 days later you try to meditate and you don't know why it's not happening, that's television, okay? Same with newspapers and magazines. It's not that it's evil to read the news. You should know what's going on, okay? It's that we read more than we need or will ever possibly use. If you ask an addicted New York Times reader what they read 2 days ago, they can't tell you more than one or two articles. Try. You know, check. That information is just running around in their brain, little nonsense syllables. You know, they can't remember what they read 3 days ago in the New York Times. So it's not having any good effect on you. It's just for relaxation, really. So do a few pages. I always do the cover on the way to my first class because it's free. You know, I just stare there and look. When it gets to halfway down the sheet, I never find out what happened, you know. And that's fine. Then you'll be up on world news enough, you know, and that'll be okay. So if you don't do that and you're always, like, addicted to reading the newspaper just to read something, it'll disturb your meditation. Okay, that's the point, all right? You can add here sex. As long as you're not a monk or a nun or anything like that, some sex on a moderate basis is fine, no problem. It's not sinful. It's enjoyable, I guess, and whatever, you know, it's there, and you can do it, and it's fine. There's no Buddhist thing at all that you can't have sex from time to time. The point is, don't do it or don't think about it to the point where it disturbs your meditation, okay? I mean, do it in moderation. You know, don't get hung up on it. Don't get obsessed with it. And then it will start ruining your meditation. Okay. Later on, if you can, you might want to experiment with consciously not having it for some period of time. And you get some very nice inner strength. Okay, and I'm not trying to make you all celibate, okay? It's not my goal tonight. What I'm saying is you might want to try it just for some length of time. Say, okay, let me try it for 6 weeks or something and see what it feels like. And you'll start to feel this kind of inner energy, a very interesting level of energy if you keep it up for a long time. I can tell you it's much of the sexual drive is a learned thing. Much of the sexual drive is something that your culture has brainwashed you into believing in. And it's not necessary, totally, thing that you have to do all the time. It's not, you'll learn if you try, if you practice, that it's not a natural drive. You know, it's something that you can turn inward and make some very beautiful energy out of it. I'm not saying sex is bad or immoral or dirty or anything like that. I think it's probably a very beautiful thing. Things happen with your channels during that time, which are very holy things, great things. But there's also this beautiful advantage to purposely restraining from it for some period of time, and you'll see some really wonderful energy in your body and in your mind. Like very, your endurance becomes much more, your peace becomes much more. Everything about your body starts to change a little bit. So I suggest try it once in a while. The same thing with silence. You know, a lot of the times when we do retreats, which can go from 3 days to, say, 45 days, we ask people not to speak during that time. And then the energy all turns inward, and you start to store up energy. And all the energy that you expend when you speak becomes inwardly turned, and it's very beautiful. And some of the people on our last retreat in December, it was a 10-day silent retreat, told me they had never been silent for a whole day. And then they did it for 10 days. And these beautiful things happen to you. You know, your mind gets much clearer. You start to have very beautiful thoughts. And you should try it, okay? We'll do some retreats up at the Connecticut place, okay? We're going to try to do more this year, like 3-day retreats, and make it easier to go. You know, you just can go easily, and then maybe you can try some of them, okay? Next one is, what number are we on? Nirsim. Say Nirsim.
Nirsim.
By the way, this is the last one. Nirsim.
Nirsim.
Nir means to hurt somebody. Sem means thoughts to hurt somebody. The ancient scriptures, Arya Nagarjuna, 17 centuries ago, he says, Duryun is a bigger problem. Duryun comes all the time. What? Thinking about what you're going to eat for breakfast, thinking about having music go through your mind, thinking about what you're going to do at work today. Those are very, very common problems that they peck away at your meditation. They damage your meditation like that, you know. They bother you. Klesh in Sanskrit, klesha. They pick away at your head and you know, you're trying to concentrate and it's like that. This is a different one. Nirsam means to start thinking about someone you don't like. Okay? That's Nirsam. This one has a different effect on your meditation. It destroys it completely, immediately. Okay? You pop out of meditative state in about 30 seconds. Okay? So it's much different. Like desire objects kind of enervate your meditation. They suck the energy out of your meditation. Thinking about someone you don't like, thinking about someone you want to have a fight with tomorrow at 4 o'clock or something will just destroy your meditation like that. It'll just disappear like that. Okay? And you'll be out of a state of meditation immediately. Okay? The point is, it's very beautiful. Nagarjuna taught these potential problems to your meditation, and then he said, by the way, it's not problems that you get when you sit down and cross your legs. You have to avoid these the other 23 hours of the day. Okay? So as you go through your day, if you want to become a real meditator, as you're at work, you say consciously, and do this, okay? Check it out. If you want to become a serious meditator and see all those other things that I talked about, which you can see if you meditate properly, you can see your future lives. Some guy was trying to talk me into proving future lives the other day, and I was just dying to say, look, just meditate seriously and you don't have to ask me about it. You'll see it, you know. But you can't tell that to a normal person, you know, unless they're in a class and something like that. But I mean, you can see those things. You don't have to ask me, oh, prove it, you know, blah, blah, blah. See it yourself. But you have to learn to meditate deeply. So what I'm trying to say about this preparation, called daily preparation, the other 23 hours of the day, you have to remember, I want to be a Milarepa. You know, I want to be a great meditator. So therefore, I decide to have a certain lifestyle that will make me a good meditator. So, you know, when you're at work and some guy's starting to piss you off, then you say, look, you're really ugly, you know, and you really irritate me. And you know what? Let's let it go today because I want to meditate good tomorrow. You know, or somebody, you know, you get a box of chocolate chip cookies from your mother, which happened to me today. And you're like, well, I could eat the whole thing. And I'm nearly not going to meditate tonight because I got that class, but then I'd also have a stupid meditation tomorrow morning. And then you just leave it. You see what I mean? So I'm talking about very simple method of learning to meditate very sharp, which is just avoid these things. Avoid the newspaper too much. Avoid food too much. Avoid music too much. Not because it's sinful or wrong or blah, blah, blah. It's just that you won't be able to meditate well. Okay? So that's like a lifestyle decision to meditate well. Next class we'll go into the actual how to sit, how to prepare the room, how to prepare the space, how to prepare your mind. Okay? We'll do a short prayer and then we'll stop. Okay?
Salam yeshe tumme, Amma